welcome back to a brand new episode of the Silmarillion Film Project. I'm your co-host, Dave Kale, and we have an exciting but also bittersweet episode today because we are not joined today by the Tolkien maven, Trish Lambert. She has other engagements, but fortunately, the Tolkien professor, Corey Olson, is with us, as always, and we are joined by some special guests who are going to help us discuss the script outlines that they have produced for us. So we're plowing ahead. We're this thing's happening. We're writing script outlines. We're writing scripts. We're developing the story. And now it is our chance as the studio, the faceless studio suits, to criticize everything they did and network note them to death.
That's right. That's right. We've been really looking forward to putting other people on the hot seat and criticizing all the stuff that they've done. So this will be exciting. Mm-hmm. And of course, I really love this chance to go back and review the season as well, to kind of look at the bigger picture. Of course, as we've been going through episode by episode, you know, it's easy to kind of, you know, you're kind of way down close to the ground, and it's really neat to kind of back up and sort of review the bigger picture by looking at all the outlines. We'll be looking at the outlines. The goal, I should say, for today is to look through the outlines of episodes 1-7. Just over the first half of the season. And this is all.
Which means we'll probably get through episodes 1-2.
Now, I think we can do it. We'll see. But anyway, so it is a really neat chance to go back and review. Looking over the outlines, I was like, hey, I barely remember this stuff. So that was fun to go back and sort of be reminded of the overall shape of season 2. But before we get into that, two quick announcements that I wanted to make sure to note for people. One is a big upcoming event that's happening starting next week, starting Monday, February 6th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time, is the first of two special sessions that Verlyn Flieger is doing. She's hosting another session of our seminar series. And this is going to be a really, really neat one. And she's going to be talking about two different Tolkien volumes that she's published, which has just come out in the last couple of years. The seminar, this seminar is going to be called Tolkien in the Dark. Verlyn is going to be talking about the sort of the early and much darker than people are accustomed to thinking about Tolkien works of his earlier life. In particular, she's going to be talking about Kullervo, the story of Kullervo, which, as many of you may know, is kind of like the proto-Turin Turambar. This is when Tolkien was still doing Kalevala fanfic before he'd fully adapted it into his own mythology and kind of took the ideas, you know, a lot of the ideas from the Kullervo story and really kind of gave them a home with Turin Turambar. This is when he was just like, hey, I want to do my own version of the Kalevala story. And so he rewrote the story of Kullervo. And this is something, so the story of Kullervo is literally, the earliest writing we have from Tolkien. I mean, it was like the first creative work that has survived.
Nice.
Really, really early Tolkien. And the other is the very recently published Lea of Eotru and Etrun, which is this, which is, I would guess, I mean, of course, at least, you know, until now, until it's published, one of the least read Tolkien works of all. I mean, I don't think there are any Tolkien works that are read less often than that, with the possible exception of Finn and Hengist, because it's, you know, that's sort of for the Anglo-Saxon diehards. But anyway, it's really cool. So let's just sort of keep in mind that date, Monday, February 6th, and then the week after she'll be doing the second one. So I believe she'll be talking about Kullervo this coming Monday. So I just wanted to, you know, everyone's invited, and I hope you'll be able to make it Monday, February 6th, 5:30 p.m. Of course, it will be recorded and posted afterwards if you miss it. But of course, if you come live, then you have the opportunity to, ask questions of Dr. Flieger and be involved in the conversation more directly. So just wanted to make sure people knew that was coming out. The other thing is not exactly an announcement, more of a reflection exactly, but this has been an incredible week. I just wanted to kind of talk for a second about how awesome this week has been. The two sessions that I broadcast earlier this week were both of them like monumental. It kind of seems a little bit melodramatic to say that they were life-changing, but honestly, it was like close to that. The two sessions I did back-to-back on Tuesday night and Wednesday night are like absolutely red-letter occasions. On Tuesday night, I was doing my Exploring the Lord of the Rings class, the one that I host in the Lord of the Rings Online on twitch.tv, and I was addressing the passage from which springs one of the most persistent questions I've ever gotten about the Lord of the Rings. So it's like a major thing that I, but it's not just something that everybody always asks about. It's also a question that I've always been crappy about answering. So it was a huge, huge deal for me because I basically kind of feel like I finally figured out what's really happening there much, much more clearly than, I sort of emerged from that with more of a like, wow, I finally understand what's really happening here kind of thing. And it was such a critical moment. And the moment in question is Gandalf's conversation with Frodo in Chapter 2 of The Fellowship of the Ring. And the question that is always asked of me is like, what the heck is up with Gandalf? Why is he so slow in the uptake? Shouldn't he have kind of glommed on to the fact that this was the Ring of Power earlier? And why did it take him 77 years to sort this out? And what the heck has he been doing with himself? A lot of people talk about this like this is just an obvious like sort of error, like kind of gap in Tolkien's story, that it just kind of doesn't make sense that Gandalf hasn't figured this out sooner and doesn't do anything about it sooner. So it's a good question, and it's an interesting question, and as I said, I have never thought that I've given a good answer to that question. I've answered it dozens of times, but usually crappily. So I was super excited going through. So that session was really, really fun. Going through, you know, we went through that whole section pretty much paragraph by paragraph, you know, tracing the line of Gandalf's reasoning and looking at, like, for instance, I had never really noticed how evasive Gandalf is. And I finally saw why. I finally figured out why. Like, what's bothering Gandalf? Why is he being as elusive as he is? What, you know, Frodo has to ask his question twice and really screw him to the point before he can get Gandalf to answer the question, which is, how long have you known all this, Gandalf? Because, of course, it turns out, as Gandalf eventually explains, and, of course, the all this that Frodo is asking about is the thing that Gandalf leads the conversation with, which is, yeah, that ring that you have, turns out it's destroying you and going to eat your soul, right? And Frodo's response to that is, huh, so how long have you known about this, Gandalf? And Gandalf doesn't answer it. And then when he does, he hems and haws about answering it because the answer to the question is, well, I've known it pretty much for sure for the last 17 years. I've been pretty suspicious of it for about 77 years. And let me explain why I never mentioned it to you. And I've been allowing you to possess this thing, which I've known to be probably eating away at your soul for the last 2 decades without me even telling you about that fact. Gandalf is feeling distinctly awkward about that. Gandalf seems to feel guilty. Anyway, just the whole scene was really, really cool, and it was really fun. So I, if you've ever wondered about this scene, if you've ever had that question that I'm talking about, I strongly recommend. We had a great discussion about that on Tuesday night. So that was episode five of the Exploring the Lord of the Rings class. But then, that class was awesome, but it was totally overshadowed by Wednesday night. In Wednesday night's Mythgard Academy class in The Return of the Shadow, we were looking at, here we are going through The Return of the Shadow, and we came to what I am convinced is the most important paragraph, the most important sentence that Tolkien ever wrote. It's incredible. It's just like the way that this emerged and what we said. That was like possibly the most exhilarating class I've taught in like 5 years. It was incredible. And the thing is, what we've been looking for in the Mythgard Academy series, we've been going through the History of Middle-earth series, and one of the big questions that we've come to the History of the Lord of the Rings, so we're doing the Return of the Shadow, and one of the big questions was, I've argued many times before that when Tolkien wrote The Hobbit, of course, there are all those apparent Silmarillion references, all those kind of pseudo Silmarillion references. And but I've argued many times, those aren't really Silmarillion references. That's Tolkien recycling ideas from the Silmarillion, but he's not really setting the Hobbit in the Silmarillion world. There's still sort of an imaginative firewall up between the two things. And when he starts The Lord of the Rings as a sequel to The Hobbit, it's still there. And I think you can see it. And I've argued as we've gone through the Return of the Shadow, whenever we have gotten to occasional references, reuse of names and concepts and things like that from the Silmarillion mythology, that he's still doing the same thing. He's still recycling. Just in the chapter, for instance, in which the Hobbits are traveling from Bree to Weathertop, there's a reference to Gil-galad and the Last Alliance. And there too, I my argument is that he's still recycling. It's the same way as like the use of the names of Gondolin and Elrond in The Hobbit. He's not really joined those two worlds perfectly yet. And I think there's evidence that shows that that's the case. So what I've been waiting for, of course, we all know, eventually, The Lord of the Rings, during the process of the writing of The Lord of the Rings, is where the two worlds really come together, where the world of The Hobbit really meets the world of the Silmarillion, and it becomes one big, really incredible thing. And that's the thing which is going to be the turning point for Tolkien. Like, that's where the magic happens, right? When the great mythology he's been working on becomes joined to, you know, the fantasy that he's actually writing and publishing, you know, and the result is the magical thing that has drawn us all in and made us fans for life. But when does it happen? And how does it happen? When does the firewall come down? And we got there. It came on Wednesday night. We came to the passage where it happens, and it was so, so exciting to see. The answer, by the way, is the Beren and Luthien story. Like the moment that it happens is when, of course, the guide that is leading the hobbits from Bree to Rivendell is not yet Strider, the man, of course. It's Trotter, the hobbit. But when Trotter says that he will tell them the story of Beren and Luthien, that's when it happens. That is the moment. So the sentence I was referring to, what I think is the most important sentence Tolkien ever wrote, the thing which changed Tolkien's entire life, and a bunch of ours as well, is, "But I will tell you the tale of Tenuviel in brief, for in full it is a long tale of which the end is not known, and there is no one that remembers it in full as it was told of old, unless it be Elrond." That's it. From then on, the two are joined. And he goes on to include the poem, of course, his revision of Light as Leaf on Linden Tree. And we spent like the whole second half of the class on Wednesday night looking at the poem and how he changed the poem from the earlier version of that poem in The Ways of Beleriand. And you can see how he is embodying the mythology in the poem now in a much more direct way than he was even back when it was included in The Children of Húrin. And anyway, it was awesome. Like, it was just incredible. So even if you're not following the Mythgard Academy series and reading The Return of the Shadow with us, you know, Wednesday's class, it was session number 7 on The Return of the Shadow. Both of those episodes should be posted to their various podcast feeds and stuff like that. So I just sort of wanted to share, and I know I've gone on for a long time about this but just like, dang, this was such an important, those two nights back to back of like feeling like I finally have like understood a passage of The Lord of the Rings that I never understood, that has always kind of troubled me. And then immediately the next day finding, like making what, you know, sort of felt like a discovery, and I don't mean no one's ever noticed it before or anything, but But for me, it was a discovery, and that was just so much fun. It was just incredible. So, David, where you can find that, the Mythgard Academy is the name of the series. The easy place to look for both of these two things is on our YouTube channel, the video recordings of both the Mythgard Academy and the Exploring the Lord of the Rings series are on our YouTube channel. So just go to YouTube and search for Signum University. And you'll find it there. There are separate playlists for each of the Mythgard Academy classes. So you just look for the Return to the Shadow playlist, and you'll find it there. And there's also a playlist for Exploring the Lord of the Rings. So
also, if you should just be subscribed to the Tolkien Professor feed on iTunes, so that you get everything.
Yeah. That's true, yeah, and that way you'll get the audio from Exploring the Lord of the Rings. That will come through the Tolkien Professor podcast feed as well. Now, the Mythgard Academy one is actually a different feed. There's a separate feed for the Mythgard Academy, but you can subscribe to that on iTunes as well. We made a different feed for that because it's not all Tolkien. It's only about half Tolkien. We do every other book we do is a non-Tolkien book. Okay, well, technically the rule is we can't do any book by any one author twice in a row. Like we can't do two books in a row by the same author. But in practice, with our demographic, what that means is you can't do two Tolkien books in a row. You can only do every other book a Tolkien book, which is pretty much what we've been doing.
But that is what happens.
Exactly. In practice, that's what it's kind of turned out to be. But anyway, yeah, it's been really neat. So okay. I know it seems weird to do like an announcement where I'm like, advocating for classes that I recorded earlier in this week, but I just wanted to share how, revolutionary for me. I feel like I'm emerging from this week with my whole perspective changed. I'm just very moved. So just wanted to share that. Good. So let's get to the outlines. A quick note before we begin, in case I forget at the end, thank you, Marie, for reminding me. Of course, remember that casting is going on. The nominations for casting the roles for season two is going on. We're planning to talk about that in a few sessions, but in the meantime, we are giving you guys time to do some research and make some nominations for what actors and actresses you would like to see cast into the roles of the elves in season two. Here, Marie says that we have 30 roles. Total that we're casting for. No, wait, we have more than that. Don't we have more than 30? We have closer to 40, don't we? But anyway, she says currently that there are 30 of the roles have three or more nominations, six of them have two nominations, and only two roles remain without a nomination. So, we don't have a nomination for Celebrion? Nobody has nominated somebody for Celebrion? Oh, come on now. Come on now. So they're 37 total, Hakan. Thank you. Celebrion and Iminye, the dead mothers of Arwen and Indis. Okay, so Ingwe's wife and Arwen's mom, right? Okay. So come on, we need to cast somebody to play the dead mothers. This is what we need still. So yeah, I'm surprised about Celebrion. I would have thought that. And I, by the disclaimer, I know I'm mispronouncing that name. I know. Lay off. I'm gonna carry on mispronouncing it. I'm never going to pronounce Celebrion's name properly. It's just I've come to live with that, and so should you. But I know Celebrion isn't dead. I know she's in it. But like the two mothers who pass away into the West, Indus's mom and Arwen's mom. Exactly. Deadline. So yeah. So Marie, how's this working again? So we've got we're a week delayed because I was sick last week. So we're going to have another session next week instead of 2 weeks from now. So we're going to finish the outlines next week, he says very confidently. And then we were going to do. So we wanted to close the nominations by next time, right? So that we can begin voting for the winner among the nominations. So we're going to have voting happening starting next week-ish, right? So that we can have the voting to be able to talk about it the week after that, or the session after that. That is my memory, my dim memory, of the projection there. So, no wait. Marie says voting opening's fair. So when do Marie? When are nominations going to be closed? When do we just sort of have to decide by executive order that we have to find some member of the cast of Firefly to make Celebrian or something? Oh, we're going to close nominations on Monday. Okay. All right. All right. Yeah. Well, that's a lot then. Yeah. Okay. Pick a date. So yeah, well, Monday then. All right. We'll say Monday. So get to nominating. Yeah. Get to nominating. We need a Calabrian. Indus and Arwen need moms. So let's get to that. And please do review those. Of course, you may ask, where can I find these things? On silmfilm.mythgard.org, on the discussion forums that we have set up, is where you can find the casting forum in order to do this. And you should also be able to find, guys, the outlines are there, right, as well, in the discussion forum, so people can see the outlines that we're going to be talking about here today. Nick, good. I am glad that at least one member of the Firefly cast was added to the nominees. I certainly had. I will be disappointed if the entire cast of Firefly is not cast in some film at some point or other.
I believe it's Kaylee. I forget the role though.
Oh, Kaylee got nominated? Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent. What's her real name? Jewel or something?
Jewel State.
Jewel State. Yeah.
I think that's right. Yeah,
unfortunately, yeah. The guy who played Shepherd Book is dead, isn't he?
Yes, he did. Sadly, Ron Glass.
Yeah, Ron Glass died. That's why I thought. I thought I remembered that. So that is sad. That
he was barely in the movie, though. So you know, it's.
I know, but the movie was not nearly as good as the series, and he was great in the series.
Yeah, I just try not to think too much about the movie.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, the movie introduced me to the show, so it can't be that bad.
I agree. It's good. It just it doesn't have the spirit. Anyway, never mind. We don't have to get into detailed Firefly criticism, but yeah, Marie, I agree. Nathan Fillion clearly has to be a human, so we do have to wait a couple seasons to cast Nathan Fillion. I can't see Nathan Fillion as an elf, definitely. But anyway, okay, all right. Let's get to the outlines. So we are joined by Nick Palazzo here, who you're going to be the spokesperson for the outlines. So you're the one that we get to put on the spot, which is awesome. So I'm going to start with a brief synopsis, and Nick, you can correct me if I'm butchering the synopsis. This is me doing an outline of the outline, right? Which is always perhaps a bit shaky, and you'll let me know if I get things wrong. So just to recall for everybody. Yeah, episode one is, and then yeah, Dave, you can condense what I say right so, like, into a tweet, so it's perfect. It's like the
good point.
You know, the like distilled essence of the outline, having passed through a bunch of different hands. So the first outline is the awakening, right? The awakening of the elves, and we have the. We started with the frame of the attack on Celebrian and her being taken by the orcs in the pass, and we have sort of the juxtaposition of that with the hunter who is taking elves from around Cuivien, and of course Arwen being disturbed about this, and Celeborn telling her about how, you know, this has been an issue since the Elder days, and then we have the Orome comes in. Right, so there's an Orome sighting. You know, he sees them and they see him, but they don't yet have the full interaction because he goes back to report to the Valar. Then, of course, as we recall from season one, the Valar, in response to the finding of the elves, decide to unleash their war. They make the decision to do the war that begins all wars at the end of season one. But we get this from the elvish point of view, and they hear the rumblings in the distance, and there's, you know, and of course, as we recall from that battle, the way that we wrote it last year, there is near the end an attack directly, an attempt to destroy the elves at Cuivien, which is barely circumvented. So they see that, of course, you know, there's like fire that comes right to the edge of the lake of Cuivien itself. And then after that, Orome comes and there's a lot of fear and uncertainty. And then the three ambassadors led by Ying Wei who go over and meet with him. And that's how the episode ends, with the three of them coming to, though we don't, Nick, as I recall, we're not imagining actually getting dialogue between them. It's just sort of them going over and standing before Orome, and that's where the episode ends.
That had been a point of some discussion. My thinking was that we don't need to have any dialogue there except maybe a basic greeting. Mm-hmm. And that's it. There had been some discussion of maybe a small conversation happening, but I personally am in favor of, at the most, just, you know, hello.
Yeah, it kind of seems to me like it would be anticlimactic. Like, almost any kind of conversation they have, it would be hard to end the episode. Like, it'd be easy to end the episode with a visual tableau, right? But it would be hard to be like, hey, hi, I'm Ying Wei. Who are you? Like, I'm Orome. I come in peace. Okay, that's nice. Like, where does the conversation end? Like, what's the fit moment, like, the, you know, to roll credits exactly in that conversation? I'm not really sure. So it kind of does seem a visual tableau would be sort of the safest. What do you think about that, Dave? Any thoughts about that conversation, or is there like a point in a conversation between them where we could stop, or like a single line that could be delivered perhaps between them? Can you see how that could work at the end of the episode?
It's hard to imagine doing it in a way that's not going to feel silly.
Yeah. And of course, the whole like I come in peace thing. You know, one of the things obviously that we have to
not do that.
Well, exactly. I know, right? But that's the thing. I mean, one of the things that we have to deal with when we have this kind of encounter is that, you know, we're going to have like alien encounters in 100 science fiction movies looming in the background of people's minds, right?
Well, not just that, but also first contact between cultures,
right.
Especially between cultures that are more advanced versus cultures that are more, for lack of a better word, primitive technologically.
Right.
That's the same kind of thing. So there's cultural baggage that comes along with that as well.
Right, exactly. Yeah. We don't want them to look like, you know, we don't want the Valar to look like imperialists or colonists or something like that. Yes. Yep, I agree. So, I suppose then the safest thing would be also in that sense to have no dialogue, because again, any line that I can think of giving them, I don't know. It would be a hard line to write, a single line, or, you know, how the dialogue would go.
Just having Ying Wei say a greeting in Elvish is the only thing I can think of that would work. From my point of view.
Right. But even that, I mean, what would it be? But more importantly, what would the point of it be? That is, what would we want to convey in that one line? I would think his reverence, right? But even that might come across kind of weird. I mean, how does he greet him? Does he call him Lord, for instance, right? Showing reverence for him? And if so, does that come across weird? Because he's never met him before. He doesn't know what he is. Right. The fact that a bunch of the other elves are like, dude, this guy could be the hunter. You know, some mysterious horseman has been hauling people off out of the woods. And now you're going to go up to the first mysterious hunter who rides up to the shore of the lake and you know, be fine with that.
Just going to say hello.
Yeah, exactly. We're just going to. Yeah.
Well, that's the basis of the whole conversation before they leave. So, yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So given that. You know, his response, you know, what he actually says is, I mean, it's a step beyond, you know, if Ying Wei has gone as far as saying, no, we should go meet with him. I am willing to go meet with him. I think that we should not just cower here. We should not run away. I think that we could, okay. But again, but what does he do? You know, does he go whole hog and show reverence and, you know, something almost like worship? In which case he might look like a mindless zealot, and we wouldn't want him to look like a mindless zealot. Exactly. You know, I don't know. It is tricky. And I do think the easiest way to circumvent it is just to have it be a visual tableau. We can show him standing there sort of in, respect and even fear. And have, you know, maybe the final image of that scene is just Orome smiling at them, right? You know, when they come over and Orome smiles, you know, show his happiness at seeing them. And because, again, remember, one of the interesting elements here, one of the things that I love most about the episode one outline is just the I love the Elvish perspective and what you guys have done with the Elvish perspective. I love the way in which I think it works really well to be going back over terrain that we did at the end of the last episode or at the end of the last season, but to be persistently Elvish in the point of view, you know, pretty much through the whole thing, so that we're really kind of seeing, like, here's what this would look like from their point of view. And because, again, from the viewer's point of view, they know who Orome is, right? And they know that he is trustworthy. And what's more, they know what lies behind his visit, especially his second visit. But the elves don't. And so being able to... So the way in which, like, sort of showing Orome's delight at the response of Ingwe, you know, and the other ambassadors there at the end, is, I think, a really good way to kind of, at the end of the episode, make a connection with the audience's perspective, right? It's like Orome sharing a moment with the audience, in a sense.
Leaning on the fourth wall a little bit.
Sorry, go ahead.
I said leaning on the fourth wall a little bit.
I was going to say, if we wanted to be really hokey, we could have a wink at the screen.
Right. Right, exactly. Yeah, not quite so far as that. But exactly. I mean, it's to at least have the audience aware of the fact that they, like, you know, sort of share an understanding with Orome. And therefore can appreciate the significance of what has happened. And Marie, I agree. The courage of Ingwe in reaching out to Orome is, that's the note that we want to strike. It's not like blind zealotry, but his courage that that is really emphasized. Definitely. The way it works with the battle is the way that the Elvish perspective works with the battle is really, really good. The fact that it looks like how that is going to feed in on their reactions. Cause it's, you know, the text itself, the Silmarillion emphasizes that the form of the fact that the Dark Rider had taken that form, both had the effect of making some of the elves pointedly suspicious of Orome, and the narrator reveals had been intended to have that effect, right? So we already have that, and we have that, you know, the first time that that Orome shows up. But the way that you guys have interjected the Elvish perspective on the battle is super cool, I think, because of course the way that you know, that's something that the text doesn't emphasize exactly. There's no reason to think that the elves would not be aware of this. I mean, there were major repercussions, like on a geological level, to that first battle. So there's no reason to think the elves weren't aware of the fact that something was going on, right? But I love the way that you guys have imagined that, you know, that so first they have the Dark Rider kidnapping folks. Then this Shining Rider appears, and they're really not sure what's up with that and whether they can trust this guy. And then, like, it appears like the end of the world is coming, and there's this cataclysm that is that comes at the end quite near to it. It looks like destruction is about to... And so then they're, you know, the speculation that leaves them with, right? What does this mean? What, you know, who was doing that? You know, who is... what kind of trouble is brewing for us over the horizon that we're hearing all of these horrible sounds and seeing all these terrifying sights, and then the Shining Rider shows up again, right? Is this a good thing or a bad thing? And the way that really amplifies the uncertainty to them of the situation and everything, I think that's great. I think that works really, really well. I was really excited about that reading through the, you know, coming back to it again and reading it through.
Yeah, well, I forget who it was who had said it, but somebody at some point came up, you know, realized wait a minute, this battle is going on for years, for decades.
Yes.
This is not something, this isn't just happening and then, you know, oh, well, that's over and we move on with our life. It, the world is shaking and going crazy for years, mm-hmm. and then it stops.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's got to be terrifying in itself. Like, what does that
right.
mean? Yeah.
Because you have, you know, like, kids have grown up with the world being like this.
Yes. 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 Notably, or not, Celeborn. Or they've stopped procreating. Yeah, but exactly.
Well, yes,
yeah.
But, well, like, we open up with Celeborn as, like, a teenager-ish.
Right.
And by the, it, you know, obviously, by the end of the episode, he's an adult.
Right. Right. Yeah, that was one of the things, by the way, kind of general comment. The passage of time and the way you guys handled the passage of time, I found really interesting. And interesting in the sense of, like, I'd be really interested to see how it actually worked. Because there are a bunch of episodes like that. A bunch of episodes in which lots of time passes during the course of the episode, right? So, like, we're to understand that the... you know, in the course of the, like, 1 hour episode that you're watching, possibly centuries have of time have elapsed. And not just in a single gap, right? Not just a, like, you know, we come back from a commercial break with the legend, you know, 150 years later, you know, but just sort of like scene by scene, we're sort of expected to, and on the one hand, I think that's it's likely to be challenging to really convey that, and it might come across as strange at times. You know, when people be like, "Wait, why is, you know, why is this guy aged so much in the last 5 minutes?" Right? But at the same time, if it could work without confusion or seeming strange or funny, I really like it. I like hope it works. Essentially. Because the general impression that I got from the way that you guys did handle the passage of time over the course of the outlines was essentially that you guys were just kind of sort of trying to operate within an elvish context. Because this is how it would seem to them, right?
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
Like it's...
Well, and yeah. Things happen. Like, people grow up, buildings get erected. So, like,
right.
You know, you can show, like, for example, during the building of Tirion, which we're going to get to, you can show over time, you can show the, you know, the structures getting taller or being
yes.
completed, so on.
Right. But those external things can certainly, though again, even there though, but it's not like we can show the steady progress all the way through. I mean, there will be scenes, right, where in one scene, you know, we're at this setting and, you know, as you say, we're seeing people like laying the foundations at Tirion, right? And then the next time we return to that location, like two scenes later in the same episode, this, you know, we're at the same spot and those,
done.
You know, those towers are now finished. It certainly does give the viewer some kind of external context to understand that time has passed, but it, like, it's still chancy, right? I mean, it could just be weird. You know, like one of those, you know, like one of those sort of joke TV commercials where every time the camera goes back to the person, they're dressed in something different, you know, it could have something almost like that. If you understand what I mean, because
well, one thing, go on.
Just because we're used to like the standard assumption, right. Is that unless we're told and time has passed now, you know, you know, you're not supposed to see this as like a continuous and uninterrupted action. That's the thing, right? Is it's like we're sort of depicting as uninterrupted action stuff that actually takes place over the course of centuries. Now, again, in theory, I love that because that's how it would be to the elves, right? They would see this thing that unfolded over the course of a century as being essentially one scene, right? And one single unbroken, I mean, who cares that it was interrupted by, you know, what to a human being would be the passage of many years, you know, or the passage of a significant chunk of their life or of several lives. That doesn't matter to them. It's not how they look at the world. So the way that this kind of immerses us in an elvish point of view, I think, I mean, if it could be pulled off, would be absolutely fantastic.
If we can make it work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this is the first time that this has happened because, like, because we're going to get these realizations that, oh, that took a long time. as we go on. For example, the battle, the war to begin all wars, mm-hmm. in episode 13 of season 1, that looks to us, the viewer, like it's over in a few hours.
Right.
But then we're going to come back in this episode and show that, no. That went on for years.
Right, right.
And we're going to get these realizations as time goes on. No, the elves are not just super fast builders.
Right. Right, exactly. And I love that. And you know, the fact that correlates with the shift in perspective, right? When we look at things from the Valar point of view, here's what it looks like. But when we look at things from the Elvish point of view, here's what it looks like. And of course, we're setting up the fact when we look at things from the human point of view, here's how it's going to look. I think it's a gutsy thing to really depict. And I say, you know, gutsy, I don't know that we have much way around it, frankly. We're kind of stuck with it because it is the reality of Elvish perspective. But it's really fun to kind of be thinking about that deliberately, and working on how that gets depicted. I agree. Marie says that Celeborn growing up from child actor to adult is essential for showing the passage of time. Absolutely. Yeah. No. The markers that time is passing and that, you know, that we're getting that, you know, that's. I guess the issue that I'm trying to point to is what could be the cognitive dissonance between, on the one hand, we are showing people the different scenes within this episode are disconnected in time, and yet at the same time we're telling them this is one continuous scene. You know, this is one episode in the life of the elves, even though it's protracted over the course of centuries, and we can see the evidence of time passing around them. And those two things, I think that people are not really used to. It makes me think, of course, of the, it makes me think, because I'm both a nerd and an English teacher, about the 18th century Shakespeare debates, right? You were probably taught, everybody was probably taught in high school at some point about the classical theatrical unities that Shakespeare broke, right? You were supposed to maintain in a play the unity of place and the unity of time. That is, you know, the scene that is depicted on the stage is supposed to be one scene, right? And it's supposed to take place during the course of one day, so that you're basically watching contemporaneous action. And how Shakespeare famously broke those unities and didn't do things, you know, the way that he was supposed to. And all of that stuff is all a little bit not really true to what happened historically, but it's fine. Anyway, everybody kind of, you know, that's how people are taught this in English classes. And the point is, of course, as the later critics who criticized the critics who said those silly things about the unities said, it's not really how imagination works. We don't actually demand the unity of place and the unity of time when we're watching a drama unfold. Samuel Johnson very famously said, someone who can imagine that the wooden stage in front of them is Alexandria, is capable of imagining more, right? You know, they're capable of imagining in the next scene that it's Rome. That's not, in fact, too much to ask. But still, one of the ways in which I think the idea of the unity of time still does apply is if you just cut from one scene to another and you don't okay, this is later, like this is a different storyline. This is there's a gap between what happened in the last scene and what happened in this scene. If the dialogue and the action doesn't reflect the fact that there's a gap, there is kind of an assumption that it's continuous, right? I mean, if we see these elves reacting, you know, to the battle in one scene, and then we see them debating in the next scene, we're going to assume that those things are contiguous chronologically, right? So having there be actual discontinuity discontiguity as far as that goes, I think is going to be a little bit, challenging, but Marie, it's not about needing cues. It's actually the cues that I think are going to be the problem. If it looks like the same conversation, essentially, if the background scenery, like if they're getting visual cues in the background to show that time is passing while what they view as one single conversation or debate is unfolding, that's what's going to be weird, actually. It's the presence of cues that time is passing that I think is going to be the challenge, not the absence of them, if you see what I mean by that. That's where I think the cognitive dissonance may come in.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that we're trying to do that within scenes, although certainly within episodes. So yeah, it's going to be absolutely important. It's going to be absolutely critical that there are things said and things that we see that indicate that time has moved on. So when, you know, for example, when we see adult Celeborn, somebody needs to greet him. Like, we need to know what we're going to know
Celeborn,
because
yeah.
We just saw him. Yeah, so that's an easy one. All right, but Feanor, for example, because we see him as, I believe we see him as a child and then as adult or a young adult in the same episode.
Yes,
and there needs to be an immediate reveal of who he is, or at least a quick reveal of who he is, pretty early on, so that we know that what story we're following now.
Right. Right. Yeah. 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 Well, anyway, I don't want to belabor it more than I already have, but I do think that this is a really interesting thing and will be a fascinating experiment in sort of showing the elvish view of time. Comment about the frame. I'm not addressing the outline, obviously, in any particular order. Comment about the frame. When we did our kind of frame review episode just recently, that was kind of the last episode, wasn't it? It's quite recent, actually. We were talking about the sort of the opening and the juxtaposition, you know, when to do the memory of the kidnapping of Celeborn and stuff. And as I was reading through the outline, I was just like, you know, the parallel between the Dark Hunter who is kidnapping elves in the wood and Celeborn being taken by the orcs, that is just like too perfect to this. So if in the frame episode I was entertaining the idea of doing something else, I rescind it. That's just awesome. It works really, really well. I love it. I'd say, like, had forgotten how much I loved that. So, yeah. Okay. Yes, Marie. Marie is pushing me on to episode two. You're completely right. Two quick notes, and then I'll move on to episode two. I promise they'll be quick. One, I would be careful about having there be too much discord and disagreement among the elves. This is in episode one, I mean, because I don't want to undermine the conflict that we get in episode three. When we come back and we're having the debates with the soon to be Avari, I feel like that should be jarring. It's not that everything needs to be perfect at Quivienen, right? We don't really need it to be like the Garden of Eden, but I'd kind of like it to be a little bit like the Garden of Eden, just in the sense of, like, there being harmony and concord. Fear, right? We know there's fear. We know there's uncertainty. But I think that episode three, when the conflict breaks out among them, is going to be at its most powerful if it's really the first time that kind of thing has happened, if that's really kind of shocking, right? Tony, exactly. I would like to establish that harmony is their default state. So there can be tension, you know, about do we or do we not go against Orome. But what I wouldn't want is debate. Like, I think we can show some people hanging back. Like, we can show that there's a variety of reactions. And we can even, you know, perhaps have some people saying, like, no, don't go, Ingwe, or whatever. Like, they can, but not like I don't want to have, like, debate and factions emerging.
Not animosity.
Exactly. No animosity, no factionalization, no, like, lines-drawn conflict kind of thing. Because basically, if we do that in if we let that creep into episode one, episode three is just going to look like, man, these divisive elves, like, this is just what they do all the time. Like, can they ever get along? And, you know, obviously the discord among the elves goes back really, really far, but I don't think I think we want to make sure that we don't show discord as being like the primeval state of them. Now, Karita points out very sensibly that fear can unify as well as divide. You know, do we want their fear to bring them together? Yeah, I guess, Karita, I think the way that I would kind of play that is they're all afraid. You know, they're all afraid of the war that's happening off in the distance. They're all afraid of the Dark Rider. They're all afraid when Orome shows up. I mean, who's not afraid? Ingwe's afraid, but the difference is in their different reactions to their fear and how they respond to their fear. So again, we can show differences and we can show even tension of a kind. Yeah, just not animosity, not debate, I would say. And my other one point is I absolutely loved the interruption of the feast by Orome. That is fantastic. That is just absolutely brilliant that they're having a feast of celebration of the end of the war and then their feast is interrupted by Orome showing up. That is like so delicious from a Silmarillion perspective that I just couldn't handle it. So my compliments on that touch especially. That was my favorite touch of the entire first episode. Brilliant. And of course, because it's an inside joke.
We need to find ways to insert that element at every possible opportunity.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just a trend.
Going one way or the other.
Yeah. It's fantastic. I mean, it's an inside joke, of course, that, like, most viewers won't get. But it's okay. Like, it establishes. It's like an Easter egg for people who do know the Silmarillion well. And a particularly delightful one, I think. But it also kind of establishes, you know, a really interesting, you know, sort of point of comparison for later on. I think it's really cool. Yes. Anyway, okay. Episode two, Marie, I'm off. Here I go. Episode two. So, episode two is the, Starlight episode. It's the one where, the ambassadors go to, go to Valinor. And
this was the rewrite.
Yeah, this is the rewrite. Yeah, I was looking at the rewrite of that. And so this is where in the frame we're talking about introducing the subplot of Arwen's friend who's made her decision to go to Valinor. No, wait, that's not this one. Is that this one? Yes, it is this one. It is, right? That happens in this episode.
Yes, yeah, we introduce her here, yes.
I'm not making that up. Okay, right, yeah. Okay. And we have the debate of the Valar, right? So the Valar decide, you know, they have their debate about whether or not to invite the elves. They decide generally yes, and that's why Orome has returned. And, you know, we have some behind the scenes, like, you know, concerns expressed by, you know, Olmo and others about this decision. Because, of course, as we've talked about, this is a big deal. And this is basically the Valar making a mistake. And so we want to depict the fact that the Valar are making a well-intentioned mistake here. And of course, then we get the visit of the ambassadors to Valinor and some of their interactions with the Valar and some heavy foreshadowing with Finwë and the birth of Feanor. So I thought this was, so first of all, who's the friend? We still don't have a name for the friend. I know we had talked about this being an actual Avari from the debate. What was the I mean, I could, you guys have kind of left the friend sort of blank. You've just called her friend all the way through the outlines. Nick, can you tell us a little bit about the way your thinking has gone about that?
As far as the name of the friend, or is the friend itself?
The identity of the friend. Like, what?
Okay. So our hope is to make her more or less a peer of Arwen, because As you mentioned in the last episode, last time we talked about this, she's kind of full up on mentor figures,
yep.
especially in Lothlorien. So the intention, I believe, is to have her friend be somebody who was with her in Rivendell, and they come to Lothlorien. It's like the goodbye tour, right? Because they know that she's getting ready to leave. At least that's the way that I interpreted the last time that we talked about this.
Okay. And so Marisa, she's named her Irian, which means daisy. Okay. All right. Irian and Arwen. So they're like sister figures. All right. Yeah. Carita says, since she's got twin brothers, so Arwen needs a gal pal. I get that. That's fine. So she's a peer in the sense of being equally young, right? So she, the friend, she's like a third age phenomenon?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Sure.
Okay. All right. So the friend doesn't have any recollections or connections to the... Well, is she Noldor, the friend?
I feel like that would be the most likely situation if she lives in Rivendell. I mean, there's no reason she has to be, but,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So Noldo. Because I'm thinking, because if she's a Noldo, right, we should work out her lineage, right? With whom is she connected? Like, is she, what house would she be in? I'm not saying, obviously, this has to come up in conversation, but we should know it, even if only for the purposes of future, you know, cameos and implications. But it, you know, it's obvious it's going to have some kind of significance.
Yeah, we want to make sure that in the DVD extras, the family tree is correct.
Exactly.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Because that would just be embarrassing.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, if we don't get the family trees correct. And it's good that we give proper thought to the DVD extras at this stage. Not that DVDs will still be a thing when this finally is produced, you know, but... Okay. I agree, Murray, she shouldn't be royalty. Maria's thinking she should be one of the leftover folk of Eregion, so she could be one of Celebrimbor's people.
Okay. Oh, that's an intriguing notion.
Possibly. That would make sense. Certainly, that would explain how she ended up in Rivendell, for instance. Now, Tony still likes the idea that she was Morquendi. I kind of do too, though in some ways it simplifies the thing if she's not, you know, if she's from the Noldor houses. That is, it kind of simplifies her, especially if she's Arwen's peer, right? When I was proposing her being Morquendi back when we were discussing this, that's when I was still thinking of her as more of a mentor figure than a peer figure. And if she's a mentor figure, then she would have had this longer wealth of experience and have been connected to the earlier stories. A Morquendi who's been around for the whole time and now has decided, like, the time has come to go, is in a very different place. If she's a third age Morquendi, I mean, if she's if she's just like one of the Nandor or something, who, you know, has been hanging out in Rivendell for reasons, and is friends with Arwen, and then just decides, like, okay, I'm out of here, I'm going to go to Valinor. It puts her in a different relationship, and I think possibly a more strained relationship with the whole where do elves belong question. Whereas someone who is of the Noldor and makes that decision, it's a more natural decision, in a sense. I don't know. I mean, at least as far as the themes of the season are concerned, it just seems to me to kind of work more. My
concern about her being Morquendi would be that she would have gone through every phase of the thought process that Arwen is now going through, which means that when they have their, like, final discussion, everything is going to get spilled out, and we're not going to have any room to talk about anything
right
concerning it.
Right.
So having her be Noldor makes it less of a... It means that she has not necessarily had to have gone through all of the... Like, this. She could be just doing this because that's what you do.
It's what you do, right. Exactly. And that does make more sense from a Noldor perspective, that it's what you do as a Noldor. Like, the Noldor on Middle-earth are merely tarrying here, whereas what the Moraquendi Teleri are doing is something beyond tarrying at this point. Okay. I can buy that. The idea of making her appear does make that seem to fit better. Okay, that's good. I love the setting the debate of the Valar in the ruins of Utumno. I love that. I thought that was really cool. Having the, so as soon as Melkor is taken captive, they immediately convene there in the wreck. And so this is like our farewell to Utumno, right? We're never going to see it again. So showing Utumno shattered, and Manwë sort of holding court there in Utumno, I think is a really neat sort of visual connection back to season one. I love that. And what I liked just as much in this episode was the emphasis that remind me if I thought of this. I don't think I thought of this, but I've been surprised before. I think this was your idea about the defection or the apparent or possible defection of Olmo, right? The discontent of Olmo with the decision and his resistance to that, and the idea that we would allow the question to emerge in the minds of our viewers, like, is Olmo gonna be, so having just reestablished the peace, right, through the war with Melkor, is it all gonna happen again, right? Is now Olmo gonna defect and go his own way, and there's gonna be, I love that. I mean, I think that's really neat, because of course Olmo is kind of a free agent. Confesses himself at times to be working even against the will of his peers, right? I mean, he is Olmo is obviously chaotic good, right? He goes his own way, and
he's the more elementally scary of the Valar. I mean, Mandos and Orome are scary in their own way. Olmo, though, has like the broad sweeping power of the tsunami at his beck and call.
Right.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, the fact that lurks out there is a possibility, right? The possibility of Olmo actually not changing sides exactly, because it's not like he's joining with Melko, but that the Valar might splinter again. I think that's, I love that. I mean, obviously we can't go too far with that, but I love that. I love the Vire scenes. Love them. Absolutely. Every single Vire scene you got. The way that you guys interwove the scenes of Vire weaving and the revelation of her tapestry with of her sort of prophetically ambivalent tapestry of Muriel and Finwë and baby Feanor. That was gorgeous. Absolutely loved that. In fact, I think I can safely say in episodes 1 through 7, I love everything that Vire does. Every time Vire comes in, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. The character of Vire, as you guys are developing her, she becomes this, especially since she doesn't speak, she becomes this like visual symbol of the foreknowledge of the Valar, right? She becomes the visual representation of doom. It's fantastic. That's just great. You know, Mandos is the one who proclaims doom, but to have Vire be the one like, and now, but meanwhile, behind the scenes, like, doom is being woven, right? It's anyway, yeah, it's fantastic. Karita now thinks I've given you so many compliments in a row that I'm buttering you up for something truly horrible here soon. I just really liked episode 2, actually. Okay, well, there are a couple things I would say. There are a couple criticisms I have to make, but they are totally outshone by the compliments.
Well, before you get into those, I did want to let you know that the almost subplot, I believe, was Brian's baby. So,
oh, was it? Cool.
Yes, I believe.
I like that. Well, because, I mean, that's, we can play the long game on that one, right? I mean, because that's, there are going to be plenty of times when Olmo is doing his own thing and the other Valar can be like, what the heck is Olmo up to? Like, what, is he actually trying to undermine us here? Is he playing his own game? What's, you know, is this Melkor all over again? Right? I mean, that can be a question that people are actually asking. I think that's cool. And again, that's something that will be relevant for, you know, the first 10 seasons. So, all the way up through, remember the final, like Olmo's big gambit, the Gondolin gambit, by Olmo. I mean, all that stuff is basically still Olmo going rogue. Cool. So anyway, my critiques/questions from episode 2. You wanted to have Finway doing arts and crafts time with Aule, which I think is great. In general, I like that. I think that's absolutely thing. It can't be jewels though. Jewels are a pure Noldor thing. To have him making jewels with Aule makes it look like the Noldor learned about jewel craft from Aule. And we don't want that. We want to make sure that jewel craft is like, this is something. Yes, of course, like the craftsmanship of Olmo has like led the way for, but it's really a discovery by the Noldor, and it's like the characteristic Noldoran thing. So yeah, I would definitely want them to be doing just something else, metal crafting or whatever. Yeah.
What he's doing isn't super important.
Exactly. Just, but like jewel crafting is super important. So I just wanted to mention that. The festival, and Arwen's gift. I didn't love the high elf, low elf thing. And in particular, the way in which, so in the early part of the outline, we have like, you know, Arwen has made a Varda thing, right? And Galadriel really likes it. But a bunch of the other elves, you know, the other Galathrim are like, they're like, who's that? Right? I mean, they don't really get it. And so then, you know, there's this like conversation where Galadriel sort of reveals that like, you know, a bunch of the, you know, we don't really talk about Varda much around here. She doesn't mean as much to the Nandor as she does to the Noldor. I'm not a huge fan of that. I don't know. It, on the one hand, I mean, I get it. I get where that comes from. I mean, when Frodo meets Gildor in the Shire, he says, they are the High Elves, for they spoke the name of Elbereth, right? Like, I'm not questioning it. Like, it's, if the fact that they called on Elbereth, in Frodo's mind, defines them as High Elves, it does suggest that indeed, you know, reverence of Elbereth is one of the markers of that, and that therefore, by extension, you know, the Sindar and the Nandor don't have the same relationship and wouldn't be calling on Varda. But it, I guess what I don't like about it is the way that it introduces a kind of, it would be really easy for Arwen and Galadriel to emerge from that conversation looking like snobs or like the Illuminati of the elves. You know, for them to be like, well, you and I know what's really going on, but the ignorant masses, like, they really don't. And especially because that could make Galadriel look like, but indulge the ignorant masses, and I've been living with them for thousands of years, but I've never, like, told them about Varda. You know, I haven't bothered to enlighten them in any way. It's just, I'm not saying it's not that I think it's wrong, as I said. It just, the way that it comes off, I wasn't seeing, first I felt that it could come off badly, but then secondly, as I was thinking about it, I'm not sure I see the reason why that needs to come off at all. You know, like, what is the purpose of introducing that high elf, low elf distinction? I know low elf isn't really a thing. I'm kind of joking about that, but I don't know.
Well,
I wasn't sure what we accomplished exactly from that and why we need that in the frame. There.
I can give you the reason.
Okay.
There's a couple. So the reason for having the scene as it's written now, period, is to be able to segue into Varda. That's the simplest explanation for that.
Okay.
However, the reason, I mean, because there are distinctions between the different kinds of elves, and we're about to kind of get into how that takes place. So
right.
To be able to show some kind of distinction between the high elves and the Moriquendi, to, you know, it kind of sets us up for what's about to happen next. Okay, that's the reason for it being in there. And I feel like we can, that, you know, with through specific dialogue writing and acting choices, it cannot necessarily come off like Galadriel and Arwen walk away from the servants who go back down into the kitchen downstairs. You know, like, that can be written in a way that isn't going to come off that way.
Sure, sure. I think my problem is, ultimately what it draws attention to is the gap between Galadriel and her people.
Which there is one.
Yes, but I'm not actually sure how big that would be. That is, there's lots of... We know that there is a gap between the high elves and the low elves, but we also know that in those places, as often happens, where one of the high elves comes and is embraced as the leader of a nation of dark elves, you know, a nation of Moriquendi, as, of course, first, as we get it with, first and foremost, with Doriath, right? Where Elwë is the sole Caliquendi, because he went as an ambassador over to Valinor, and he's got, you know, a Maia wife. And, you know, so the Grey Elves of Doriath are the first example. Galadriel and Lothlorien, of course, is another example. Thranduil and his lineage in Mirkwood is another example. But the thing is not just that there's a difference between the leader and the people, but that the leader, when that leader becomes the leader of those people, it changes the people. The Grey Elves of Doriath are different from the Green Elves, not just because they're culturally different because they've been separate, but they're brought upwards by Thingol and Melian, leading them and being there among them. And I think that Galadriel would also have, like, the Galathrim would not be exactly the same as cousins in Mirkwood, or as other Avari, for instance, who were, you know, further out to the east and never, you know, lived with Galadriel and Celeborn. So I think that I'm not really sure. Frodo says they must be high elves because they called on Elbereth, but I'm not sure that that particular hobbit heuristic would be correct of elves of Lothlorien. You know, he may be, doubtless he's learned that from Bilbo, right? That you can always tell, like, if they're calling, you know, that it's the high elves who call on Elbereth. This piece of elf, you know, of, well, like, hobbit elf lore, doubtless holds true, but I think the Goathrim might well be an exception to it, and that Bilbo would have recognized them as an exception had he been there, but he's never been there, so his lore to Frodo wouldn't include that. I'm just not do you see what I mean? I'm just not really sure that that would actually be true, and it seems to just put Galadriel in a weird place. Like, have you kept it to yourself, Galadriel? Like, you don't tell them about Varda? Like, so you just, what, you have a private relationship with Varda, and you're like, but the people, I mean, my people don't need to know? I'm not sure. It seems to me that the embracing of Galadriel as their leader is something that's going to change, that needs to change, that is supposed to change the Goathrim.
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt. And yes, I do think that it's possible that the Galadhrim wouldn't necessarily have any reaction to something like this at all. It's also possible that what I don't think is necessary is for it to come off like the Galadhrim don't even know who Varda is.
Right, like they're ignorant. Yes, they're
right. What they may not be super in tune with is why Arwen is connecting her to this particular event. Yes, they know that she made the stars, but why would you necessarily go ahead and, you know, we're just enjoying the stars. We don't need to necessarily focus so much on Varda making them.
Right. Yeah, we'll see. But here's the other thing. Even if there's not a pure ignorance question, right? Mm. There's still, like, it begins to sound or to feel like a religious orthodoxy question.
Mm-hmm.
And that's uncomfortable, too. You know? I mean, I'm not sure that I want it to feel like that, either. You know, like the... Yeah. Like Galadriel knows that, you know, follows the true church of the Valar and the Goathrim don't, you know, that whole weirdness I would want to avoid. Anyway, I guess at the end of the day, what I'm saying about that scene in the frame is, I don't disagree with it. Like, I'm not saying it's wrong, and I can see how it fits and I can see how it works. It's for my money, the possible downfalls outweigh the possible gains from it, I guess, at the end of the day. The ways in which that could go wrong seem to me to outnumber what we get from it, especially since I'm not sure how much foreshadowing of the divisions we need or even want necessarily. I'd kind of like to have that be shocking. Episode 3 should be like when the elves dissolve into conflict, I think should be shocking. Which is one of the reasons, by the way, also, I wasn't a huge fan of like Muriel snapping at folks. I mean, I like the meanwhile back at Quivienen, we're telling stories about those elves who went away into the West and never returned. I like that. Again, showing the passage of time and the idea that, you know, we talked about that some in the original, in our original session on it. But again, like that, I want to save conflict, right? I think that episode 3 will work best if it's the first time we've ever had elves yelling at each other.
Well, the problem is that also removes some of the conflict and drama from episodes 1 and 2. So it's a careful balancing act that we're trying to walk there.
It's okay. But see, I think there's enough to explore. There are enough ideas to explore without there having to be interpersonal conflict. I'm not a big believer in the absolute necessity of interpersonal conflict.
It comes in pretty handy in a television episode, I'm just saying.
Well, I know, but see, I don't know. I acknowledge it's what is normally done. But of course, as people know who have followed me for a long time, this is how it's always done is never a great way to convince me personally.
It could be, however, that the people who are doing it because it gets eyeballs on televisions and stuff like that.
But it also could be that it's one of the things that makes 90% of TV boring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And pointless.
To certain people, yes, but they don't make it that way because people don't watch it.
Sure. You know? Yeah. Whatever. But fortunately, since we don't have to worry about mercenary things like ratings and can focus on just like the making of the perfect artistic thing, I'm trying to think of where was the time that I, Star Trek. So I've been watching Star Trek. I've been tweeting about this. I've been doing my completionist view of Star Trek, which I began last year in celebration of the 50th anniversary. One of the things that annoyed me most about the original Star Trek series was the fact that Bones absolutely has whatever Spock says, and it doesn't matter what Spock says. Spock can be saying the most perfectly obvious thing in the world, right? You know, Spock could just be saying, there are people over there. We should go over and talk to them and see what they are. And you can guarantee Bones is going to take the opposite view. He's going to be like, no, that's just crazy, you crazy Vulcan. And it's like, and even when the things that he says are idiocy or self-contradictory at times, yet always, 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 Bones must oppose Spock, and we must have Bones and Spock giving alternate views and Kirk deciding between them. Like, that happens all the time. And, like, at times. Now, I'd love Spock and Bones. There are two of my favorite characters, and I enjoyed the original series more than I remembered enjoying it before. But that element always bothered me. It's like, and honestly, that's what it felt like was like, we have a formula that we must stick to. Like, there must be conflict. Like, you know, we can't all be agreeing. And it just annoyed me. Now, Karita asks, what would I rather see instead of conflict? There's a lot of things that you can work out. Like, people don't have to disagree. What you need is movement, right? You need to be thinking about, like, how do you get from one place to... So there can be suspense. There can be mystery. There can be, like, discovery without interpersonal conflict. Like, people don't have to fight about it. So, for instance, going back to Muriel in the camp, there can be suspense, uncertainty, loneliness. Like, are they ever coming back, right? The fact that some elves have obviously given up on them coming back and Muriel holding out hope that they return can be conveyed. The fact that she does not think that everyone doesn't think alike can be conveyed to show the different ways that people are responding to this, which, you know, it's, you know, are they going to come back? That can be a question that gets put before without them having to actually fight about it on screen, you know, without actually having to have interpersonal conflict between people on screen. That's the part of the formula that always seems to me too formulaic and that I often kind of dislike. Like, I feel like, so whenever I watch TV, which is not that often because a lot of this stuff, and I mean, I get annoyed by ill-written TV shows, and I don't have that much time anyway. When I get annoyed by TV is when it's like, how much time is spent just manufacturing conflict between people? Like, I think having people like she can be thinking about it, wondering about it, talking about it, right? She can be saying, like, no, like, they're going to come back. But it doesn't have to be, they don't have to be fighting. There doesn't have to be conflict, interpersonal conflict again.
I mean, that's fair. The only question I would have is, how would you react if you found out, if you found somebody saying that your significant other had gone off and was never coming back?
Of course, it depends. I mean, I get the fact as well. Like, I'm willing to concede Muriel, as you have depicted her, is, you know, she's fairly spunky. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, one could respond to that in sadness. Of course, obviously, it would resonate with her own fears. She has to be concerned that they're never coming back. She has to be suspecting that it's possible they're never coming back. And then, of course, different people respond to that in different ways.
That's true.
You know, either lashing out at, you know, it might lead to a melancholy interlude, or it could lead to her lashing out at the person. Either one of those things works psychologically as a response to that, depending on the psychology you begin with, right?
Right.
I do grant that the way that Muriel does it is, or rather the way that you guys depict Muriel, the lashing out does seem a little bit more likely, but.
That's the only consideration that I had in mind for that. It can be toned down. There's no question that it can be made to work. It's just, you know, it's a big deal, the thing that she's reacting to, and so I just didn't want to lose sight of that.
But I want to make sure we finish talking about episode two, or Dave's going to make fun of me, because two episodes is what he predicted at the beginning of the show.
Walking a fine line.
As you guys acknowledged in the outline, the choice of Varda as your sort of Valian protagonist is kind of gutsy. To have the scenes following around the person who is famous for listening, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, it obviously works in the sense that it's far from surprising that Varda is the one that the other Valar come to. Right. That if there is uncertainty and discontent and disagreement among the Valar, Varda's going to hear about it. Of course she's going to hear about it. Hearing about it is what Varda does. Right. So I kind of like that. But you're right that it makes her an awkward protagonist, because she doesn't act as much.
Which we wound up using as a plot point, which, you know, like that was that eventually became like, well, what does she do? Well, that's the whole point.
That's the question. Yeah. What does she do? What is she going to do? I did agree in the end that I just wanted to acknowledge the concern that you had for that. But frankly, I think I like it, even if only for the reason that we do want to, since we are going to be invoking Varda, Varda's going to be, one of the Valar who should stay most firmly on our radar screen as we move forward. I liked, having her there so that we can be really thinking about her and thinking about her relationship with the elves. All right, dashing along to episode three. Episode three, of course, is the great debate when the ambassadors return and everybody starts fighting, and we have the discussion and the Avari and Aeol storming out in wrath and the Avari choosing to stay. So conflict breaks out now all over the place. This is conflict with which I have no problems at all, of course. And also, notably, this is where we begin to see the bad guy side. This is where we get the first Angband scene, right, with Sauron?
Yes.
And then, of course, we get the decisions, some to stay and some to go at the end of the episode. Let me just mention the Angband stuff. I liked the interjection of Angband stuff. I thought that was really, I thought that worked really well. I love the idea of following the Dark Rider back to Angband, right? And kind of seeing behind the scenes there. One point I wanted to make though about Sauron, one of the things you guys said in the outline was like, why destroy something when you can use it instead, seems to be sort of his general attitude. The main thing that I would caution, remember, Sauron is a very recent convert to evil. He's not been evil very long and clearly still doesn't yet think of what he does as evil. And in fact, one of the things that I think is going to be really interesting, one of the things that I think that we can set up in this season and even continue perhaps in the next season, is that there's just as we were talking in the later part of the season about sort of the where in the continuum Morgoth himself is, right, and that shift from Melkor to Morgoth, the significance of the choice to do the darkening of Valinor, and how he has crossed a bridge at that point, and is now different, and showing the contrast between somebody who is merely, not in agreement with the other Valar, right, which is where Sauron is, willing to embrace alternative methods, right, which is kind of what his defection was all about back in season one. You know, his defection was not about like, you know, really when it comes to it, I prefer evil to good. That's not what was the issue, right? The issue was what works. And he likes Morgoth's approach, right? You know, he admires Morgoth's strength and thinks like this is the way to get stuff done, right? All that dithering over there in Valinor is totally pointless. Morgoth has got he knows the way of it. So basically, thinking about his relationship with the elves, I'm thinking he's not, his first approach isn't the question of like, should I destroy them or not? Shouldn't even, that's not even on his radar screen, right? He's not trying to destroy anything. He's not setting out to be the destructor, because, to do that would be, it would be essentially embracing evil or becoming so thoroughly corrupt yourself that you can't even tell anymore. But he's not there yet. Sauron isn't there yet. He's still he's a builder, right? He's a builder. He's a shaker. He's a builder in that he's one of the people of Aule, right? And he believes he is building. Again, his defection to Morgoth is just about, like, finding superior means, like, that is more effective means to achieve the ends. He would not view his ends as having changed, necessarily, between season one and season two. So my thought is he's got to be working on, and I use this word very carefully, conversion, basically. He's wanting to talk the elves around.
Yes.
So that should be his goal. So this will come up again later on, but so trying to kind of articulate a little bit more so maybe Gothmog sort of assumes, because Gothmog would be all about the violence, right? Gothmog, yes, would just be like, hey, we can get, and I love, this comes in later on though, but I love the elf hunt, like Balrog's on an elf hunt in the woods.
Yes.
That's awesome. Like the elves just sort of treat them as like game, essentially. That's perfect. I think that's just absolutely perfect. But showing Sauron's attitude in contrast to Gothmog's, I think is a really, because of course Gothmog has already also, like, when the Balrogs do their thing with the lamps, they've already had their moment, right? They've already crossed their bridge. Sauron has crossed an important bridge, but it's not the same, right? I mean, he hasn't been, the Balrogs have been changed, right? I mean, they are. They are irrevocably different. Yeah, they've already moved from Melkor to Morgoth, right? Following that same parallel that we were talking about at the end of season two, yes. They're already in Morgoth stage. Sauron is not in Morgoth stage yet.
I think that this was written. This was written pretty early on, and before there was really an idea of who Myron was and where he was in his plot arc. Right. However, there's one thing that I would say that, like, right now, he's kind of like the sane man in the asylum, in a way.
Right.
And
yes,
he's got to kind of get all these people to think that he's just as crazy as they are, almost, because he's not the one in charge.
Right, right.
So
right.
So he has to constantly be selling this idea that, nope, yeah, I'm on board. He's waiting for Melkor to come back and kind of order this all out, but in the meantime, he has to try to continue with his ends and have the freedom to do so.
Yeah.
So whenever he's talking to anybody, including Thuringwithel, he has to be putting on that face.
Absolutely. Yeah. No. Obviously it falls to Myron, right, to keep Morgoth's enlightened vision alive. Melkor's enlightened vision alive, right? I mean, that's what he converted to, right? Was the more enlightened vision of Melkor and achieving their ends, and then it looks like everything is just going to hell, right? Because Gothmog doesn't get it, right? Gothmog is just like,
he just wants to see the world burn,
right? Exactly. He's merely rule by force. He's all the strength, but none of the brains, none of the long-term planning at all. So yeah, to Sauron, it's got to look like Morgoth had a vision, right? But now he's gone. Gothmog is in charge, which is a freaking disaster because he has no vision at all, doesn't get the big picture. I get the big picture, but I don't have the power just to make it happen. So he's like the one who's struggling for, struggling for enlightenment, basically. So clearly what he's trying to do is recruit the elves, ultimately.
Yes.
Which means we have to explain, why does he abduct them in the first place?
Mm.
And I think the answer to that is the answer given in the text, right? Why does he take the form of a dark rider who kidnapping folks? Where you think like a more polite approach might have worked perhaps better. Well, he's got to be thinking, his first thought has got to be, Orme is going to show up, right?
Right.
And I need to make sure when Orome shows up, they don't listen to them, because, you know, he's going to wanting to be guarding against that. But still, it does seem like an odd. We do have to reconcile his tactical choice of abduction, right? But again, that kind of fits with the whole strength thing, right? You know, you want these people to be on your side. How do you get it done? You don't get it done by, like, approaching them and being like, "Hi, I'm your friend. Can we talk about this?" That's the namby-pamby Valar way, right? No, like, strength, right? That's what Melkor is about. The assertion of strength. One of the things, anyway, Melkor is about. The assertion of strength and taking what you want. That's the difference in means, right, that he has embraced. So that's what he does.
Right. And well, that's so, like, what I'm saying is that the line, you know, why destroy what you can cultivate,
right,
is that's the line he's using with the ring without. Because he's kind of playing everybody, including her, which is far more, like, playing Gothmog can't be that difficult.
Right.
He's not that smart. Whereas playing Thuringwithel, who is arguably almost as smart as Sauron is,
right,
at least in the depiction that we're writing here, that takes a lot more finesse.
Right. 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 Now, is Thuringwithel evil? Or compared to Sauron? I would think she'd be in a similar place to him. That she would be his ally in this sense as well. That he shares the vision with Thuringwethil and she with him.
She strikes me on the, because we've used this before, the D&D, why can't I think, alignment scale. She strikes me as true neutral at
true
this
neutral?
Point.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Which is, if you've ever GM'd, true
yes.
neutral is the worst
Almost
possible.
Almost impossible. Absolutely. Yes. 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 How do you maintain true neutral while in fact doing anything? Yes. Yes. Exactly.
Right. So that means that she doesn't necessarily have a moral center, which again makes her difficult to manipulate, because that's all, you know. What you do as a dungeon master is you're manipulating your players the whole time.
Right, right, right. Yeah, and it is tricky. It is tricky. Let's come back to Thuringwethel for a second. Draugluin is easy, right? Draugluin, I know we're going to get werewolves later on, and I like that. With Draugluin, what I would think with him, he would be tortured from the beginning, right? Like, the whole werewolf experiment doesn't turn out like Sauron intended, you know, like Myron intends.
Yes.
You know, he's trying to make, you know, strong, powerful allies, but they themselves turn out to be, you know, in the end, they're tormented spirits bound within werewolves. And, like, it's not like he was setting out to torment them. He wasn't tormenting them for his own amusement, but the process of becoming werewolves turns out to be a tormenting process. And Draugluin is, you know, scarred by that. Yet Marie says he's in constant pain. Yes, yes. Even if not physical pain, you know, he's in, like, mental and spiritual pain, you know. So he is, Draugluin is violent because he's broken. He's messed up. And Myron messed him up, even though, again, I don't think that was what he was setting out to do. But so Draugluin being kind of darker because himself broken is kind of that seems a little clearer to me. Thuringwethil, I would want to be more like Sauron, to be the person that he can talk to, you know. She's his sounding board. She's the one that so, like, basically the stuff about Sauron's real point of view can emerge in conversation with Thuringwethil. Maybe she doesn't have his drive. Maybe she doesn't have his overall vision. Maybe she just doesn't care as much about achieving the vision, right? So she doesn't have that kind of leadership drive that he has.
Well, she's probably been with Melkor since the destruction of the lamps.
Right.
Since the split at Almoran. So she's going to be a lot closer to Melkor's, like, real point of view than Sauron is at this point.
Right.
So I would say that she's probably a little bit further along than he is, but as far as evil.
Right, right, right. That makes more sense. That makes more sense. Yeah, yeah. Karita suggests that she's sort of more centered on survival rather than, you know,
right.
Vision in the big picture like Myron. That makes sense to me, Karita. Now, to Vildo, though. this is jumping ahead. It's the next episode. It's episode 4 where we get to Vildo the torturer, right? Who tortures elves for fun. That fits for me. I mean, he's a cat, right? So he's got to be evil. But I mean, you know, that's. I'm sorry, I didn't write it. But I'm trying to fit him into the
band. Yeah,
the picture. How is he? How and why is he an ally to Myron? Does Myron take him as an ally almost unwillingly? I mean, is he like a necessary evil from Myron's perspective?
Yeah, I would say so. He needs all the help he can get.
He's like an independent spirit, so he doesn't play well with others, right? Because he's a cat again. So he doesn't join with the Balrogs, and he won't be bossed around by the Balrogs. He refuses to be bossed around because, again, cat. But he so he's willing to kind of side with Myron, but mm-hmm. he really is more of a Balrog-ish perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, also, again, to Vildo, even though he possibly, like the Balrogs, just kind of wants to see the world burn, he might feel like he might also feel that the Balrogs lack subtlety, that they they're not really getting the most out of this.
Right. Right. Yeah, because of course, again, his idea of fun is not like the kind of hunting that that the Balrogs do anyway. Like he's not into hack and slash. That's not what he does. Yeah. Yeah. What's Tevildo's backstory? Why is he so messed up? What is he? Where does he come from? Now, of course, we don't know the answer to these questions. You know, Tevildo gets dropped from the mythology, and there is no explanation of this other than the vague impression that cats are intrinsically evil. Brian just says he's a cat, right? That's yeah, exactly. That's kind of the thing. But again, I feel like that needs explanation within the mythology as we're constructing it.
Well, what we could say that Tevildo was Melkor's first Maiar beast amalgam experiment. Now, granted, you know, Drogluin is that as well now,
right.
But this is something that Melkor did at the height of his power before. It's not as ugly as Drogluin.
Right, so Drogluin could be more messed up, be more physically and sort of or mentally messed up because Sauron, so that Drogluin could be an attempt to imitate Tevildo, essentially.
Right, yes.
And it's an imperfect imitation, and thus Drogluin is messed up, and thus evil, whereas Tevildo is more designedly, because what Melkor wanted when he made Tevildo was this kind of mercilessness.
Right, and it's possible that Tevildo was made with this particular activity in mind.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's true. I'd never thought of that. I was always picturing, because of course parallel from the beginning in the Book of Lost Tales is between Tevildo and Huon, right? So I was thinking of Tevildo in Huonish terms, meaning that he would originally have been a spirit following one of the, you know, he would have been, a Maiar who was following one of the Valar. So I was kind of thinking in terms of like, so which Valar originally should he have been following? Is he originally one of Melkor's followers who fell with him in the music, or is he somebody else who defected? But if he's not, you know, if he is that kind of a experiment, as Kurita says, the experiment that worked too well, that does simplify that question then. And it does establish the idea of Mairon kind of finding his place politically in Angmar, right? He's opposing the Balrogs, though in secret, not openly. He's made an uneasy ally of Tevildo, but that doesn't always work out really well, and there's some tension there. He has a more firm ally in Thúrin Gwethil, but she's not so committed to the cause as he is.
That's interesting, because we have her cave in episode 13, to kind of, and this is obviously jumping ahead quite a bit,
yeah,
but we have a scene with them in episode 13 where, and I forget exactly what the context is, but the Balrogs are trying to get information out of Mairon, and he's not giving it up. When they turn it loose on Thúrin Gwethil, she immediately spills everything. She's got no...
Yeah,
there's
I like
no
that.
Way that she's going to risk her life.
Yeah, because she's not about the cause.
Right.
Yeah. No, I like that. Okay. Cool. All right. Well, I console myself for that long digression in that addresses several episodes. So that's good. Both go back to the great debate.
So you've technically done more than two? That's your argument?
That's my argument. I've technically done more than two. In fact, when we finish episode 3, I will technically have done more than 3. So there we are.
Yeah.
We're doing great. Okay. So what's the purpose of Lenwe's dream? So Lenwe has a dream. I mean, I get that it's like... What I was getting from that was the general, like, one possible impulse to resolve the question of should we go or should we not is, should we seek to interpret signs and portents to tell us, you know, is there some kind of external thing that we should rely upon to see what is it that we should do in some sense of should, right? But the dream is interpreted in contradictory ways, and so therefore this suggests that, you know, there is the result of that is that no, there is no external, you know, marker that we need to be looking for. We just have to make our own decision up about this. Is that where you guys were kind of going with the dream sequence?
Yes, because we don't necessarily want to take away the agency of the elves in this case,
right?
Where every decision that they make is just being determined by what the Valar are doing or saying,
right?
But the mix up of interpretation is like. That of course that's going to happen. I mean, if you have an oracular vision, clearly people are going to misinterpret it.
Right. Now, is it oracular? Like, is he actually sent the dream? And what does the dream really mean?
So
something? They're misunderstanding it?
Well, the I believe in the original discussion that we've had with you guys where you had talked about wanting almost sending them dreams as a way of subverting what the
right.
what yes. the other Valar are doing.
Yes.
And that this is that, essentially, okay. But Lemwe is getting it wrong.
Right. Okay. As I recall, the issue of Lenwe receiving a dream from Ulmo, who is kind of working behind the backs of the rest of the Valar. As I recall, because I actually have a memory of that, which is unusual, is that we were trying to answer the question. We wanted some of the elves to be arguing, it is our purpose to remain in Middle-earth.
Mm-hmm.
And to be a blessing to Middle-earth. And we were trying to answer the question, where do they get that idea from? Like, why do they even think that? I mean,
yes,
it's very natural for them to say, I like it here, I don't want to leave, right? They don't need any kind of revelation to have that. But if there is any kind of a larger issue, right? I mean, if there's any kind of more grandiose, it is our purpose to remain. It is wrong. It would be wrong for us to go, which I think has to be on the table for at least some of them.
Yeah, that I think is Nerwin's interpretation that we mentioned in the outline.
Right.
Then I don't think it says what that is, but yeah.
Right. They have to get that from somewhere. I mean, unless we just say they're vaguely born with a general sense of this, but that would make it far too general, I think, to really fit what we're wanting to accomplish there. So, I'm not sure. Here was one thought. One thought was, why don't we save that? Well,
okay.
Because I was torn with two things. And here I'm glancing ahead at episode 4.
Mm-hmm.
When Lenway decides to stay with Treebeard and the Ents, he is moved by the conviction that this is their purpose.
Yes.
We could make... I could see a couple options of how we draw the lines in episode 3. Right? On the one hand, we could make this essentially into... Because really, I mean, if you boil it down, we're thinking about 3 different poles. Or 4 different polls, really, of the debate about whether we go or whether we stay. That is, there's the subset who says... Like, basically, there are 2 reasons to go and 2 reasons to stay. There are the people who say, we want to stay because we like it here, and that's what we want to do. There are people who stay because we think it is the right thing for us to do to stay. It's not about our desires. It's about what's right, and we believe that staying is what's right. There are those who say, I want to go because it sounds cool, right? And again, it's not about whether it's right or wrong. It's about what I want. And there are those who are going because they think it's the right thing to do. And it doesn't matter what they want. They believe that they're called to go and should go. Do we need all 4 of those groups represented in the conflict? I could see, for instance, having those be 2 separate questions. The we want to go and we want to stay. And the, it is right for us to stay, or it is right for us to go, for those to be dealt with separately, even in separate episodes.
Do you not think don't you think that would come out during people's arguments? Like then, because they're not just saying, well, I think we should go, well, I think we should stay, well, I think we should go, well, I think we should stay. They have to be articulating their positions. And
I agree.
Like, it's going to, I feel like that would definitely come out when they're doing that.
I can't see any way to avoid the I think it's right for us to go position.
Yeah.
That has to come out.
Well, that's going to be the Vanyar position.
Exactly.
Clearly.
The Vanyar position, right. Because of the Vanyar, that has to come out. But the converse, I am not sure does. Because,
okay.
See, here's what I'm thinking. What if the debate is between people who, on the one side, there are those like the Vanyar, who want to go in large part because they believe it is the right thing to do. And there are others who just want to go because they're curious and it sounds cool.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side are just people who don't want to go. But we don't have to introduce that larger sort of more ontological question among them. They can just be like, no, we don't want to. And then the distinction we introduce in episode 4, when Lenway chooses to stay. See, this would make Lenway's choice to stay a fundamentally different kind of choice than the choice that the Avari make.
when he says, "No, I'm going to actually, I'm stopping. I'm not going any further than this." And so like, well, why did you leave? If you, you know, and what he could say is, no, it's not that I just, it's not that I think the same way the Yavari did. Like, I get your desire to go to Valinor, and I respect that, and that's fine for you. But what I see now is we have a calling here, and we have a purpose here. And that is what I, and for that to be different, for, you know, so if that view is not one that's voiced by the Yavari, and the Yavari are more focused on essentially negative arguments, they're the unwilling, right? We don't want to go. We think this is a bad idea to go. Rather than, we believe it is the destiny of elves to remain.
Okay. I mean, I'm okay with that. I just wanted to kind of remind you that you had wanted to avoid the Yavari being viewed in a purely as
yes, just obstructionist, pointless. Yes.
Right. Yeah. That's all.
Exactly. So what you're saying is, like, what I'm saying totally contradicts what I said before. Yes, and I agree. I don't want the Yavari to just, I mean, it has to be handled carefully so they don't look like they're just folding their arms and sticking out their lower jaws and saying, well, we don't want to and you can't make us. We don't want to make them sound childish. Their concerns need to sound really legitimate. And indeed, they are legitimate concerns.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's a few things. There's one, you know, it's, are you nuts? Like, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard of. It's really scary out there. You know, there's Ael's point of view, which is these people are clearly just want us as pets or servants or something worse.
Like the sort of like proto-fallen Feanorian perspective, right?
And then
yes,
right. Yeah. And then there's the you know the Avari Noldoran perspective of, but I'm in the middle of building a bridge. It's going to be at least another 50 years.
Right. I'm doing stuff here. I'm in the middle of stuff. Right. Yeah, and so I think, and in that there can be the sense of, I mean, one of the things that emerges especially from that later position is the general idea of, like, here is where we are, right? We're doing stuff here. Stuff is happening here, and we want to keep doing it. We want to stay here, and we want to keep doing these things. It's not quite as grandiose as, like, I have received a vision, and we have a calling to be here, right? Mm-hmm. I believe that there is some kind of destiny, some kind of task that we must perform. It's not that grand, right? But it still gives a sense of, we belong here. I think that's okay. I think it's okay for the Yavari to say that, to say we belong here. What I would want to emphasize with Lenway is that sense of purpose, right? That like we have a job, like we have a, because they do. The Firstborn have a job, like Iluvatar designed them for a purpose, and the reason that, in my reading, the reason that the Silmarillion suggests that it was wrong of the Valar to bring the elves over to Valinor is that it undermines the purpose for which the elves were placed in Middle-earth in the first place. And so that sense, so I think this is why I'm wanting to separate that out, because I want to make sure to, I don't want that just to get tangled up with the, we're afraid to go, we don't trust the Valar, we like it here. Like those are other, obviously those are all things that are going to be on the mind of the various Avari, right? And I don't want that bigger question of, like, what is the purpose of elves in the first place? Like, what is their destiny? What are they called to do? I don't want that just to get kind of lost in the shuffle there. You see what I mean? So that's why I'm thinking we save that for episode 4. And again, it makes Lenway's separation feel completely different. He's not just another Avari. You know, he's not just the still pretty unwilling, you know. He is not unwilling. At all. In fact, unwillingness is exactly what Lenway does not show. What he shows is willingness, but it's just willingness for a different purpose. Not an unwillingness to follow a call, but the choice to follow a different call. And that's where I would want to distinguish Lenway from the other Avari, and have their arguments be negative. And again, I'm not trying to insult them, and I'm not saying we need to simplify them and to make them look silly, but just negative in the sense of they are, you know, they're focusing on what they don't want, primarily, as well as the fact that they do love where they are. You know, I don't want to lose that positive entirely, but their arguments would be mostly negative.
So are you saying
go ahead.
No, go ahead. You're fine.
I was just going to say, opportunity this opens up? Maybe the whole unwilling thing is like, could also be partially propaganda from the elves who went. Like, or just like a snobbish attitude. Like, right. Maybe indeed large numbers of the Morquendi and Teleri aren't in fact like quote unquote unwilling. They're just perceived as unwilling by the elves who went. Yeah, by the willing, by the elves who went, and by the Valar. Like, maybe it's sort of a negative reaction by the Valar. Mm-hmm. At least the ones who wanted the elves to come.
Yes, I mean, I don't think it wouldn't be hard for us to depict. I mean, there would be wisdom in the argument that the Avari make, right? I mean, it's not, again, we don't have to just make them look like they're stubborn children who refuse to listen. Their concerns are valid concerns. It's sensible. Mm-hmm. What the Eldar are doing is a risk. I mean, they're rolling the dice, and it's perfectly sensible for them to say, you don't know. Now, like, Ael's a little over the top, but nevertheless, the objections that he makes, like, what's the point? Why do they, you know, have you asked what they want with us? You know, like, I want, and I love that, you know, that line that you guys were talking about, like, him not wanting to be their pet. I would also suggest that we throw out the word thrall here, so that when Feanor brings up the word thrall, it sounds familiar.
Yes, I agree.
And obviously his fears are more extreme, right?
But it's fears that the Noldor are going to share in a few episodes. So.
Exactly. So putting that on the table is I mean, so he's wrong. Eol's wrong, as the Noldor will be wrong. But that's going to be a really fun thing, right? Where on the one hand, when Eol says it at first, we, the viewers who are fresh still in episode 3, fresh from season 1, are going to be like, oh, that's horrible. What an idiot, right? What a jerk that guy is. Think that about the Valar. And then by the time, if we do our jobs right, by the time we get to the Noldor saying that at the end of episode 2, at the end of season 2, it sounds like plausible, eerily, disturbingly plausible.
Because the Valar, despite their best intentions, are kind of almost keeping the elves, keeping like you would a pet, like not, you know, they're not like dictating to them or anything. Well, they are in a way,
right?
But they are kept, in a manner of speaking.
Yes, exactly. Marie brings up the philological question: since elves, of course, don't have slaves, where would they get the word thrall from? Marie, he would coin it. Right. I mean, Eol would be coining the word in that moment. And of course, philologically speaking, it probably would, like, the literal meaning of the word that he uses would probably be something like, you know, the kept ones or something like that. You know, taking applying to people, you know, probably a verbal construction, which was only ever before applied to inanimate objects. You know, and Eol is the first one to apply that, you know, to bring up this issue of the, you know, to conceive of that word being applied to, or adapted to people. We can totally make that work philologically if we want to. Anyway, so again, I am absolutely not arguing for flattening out the Avari argument and making it simplistic and silly. But that sense of higher calling I would want to save for Lenway, because that sort of anticipates one of the main things that I wanted to say about episode 4. I wanted a little more of that with Lenway, because it's and this can reflect the fact that we spread that out over 2 episodes, I think actually can integrate with the frame really well, right? Because what it shows is a kind of a refining of the question. Because both of those questions are like when Arwen is confronting the idea of what is the proper destiny of elves, both of those two questions are questions that she should be considering, but she won't necessarily be considering them both at the same time, or both initially. That is the question of what do I want? Do I want to stay or do I want to go? And what's right? Should I stay or should I go? And then, of course, thinking about how those two questions interact. So if we essentially have in the frame Arwen considering the first question, what do I want, or what does her friend want, in the frame of episode three, and then having the, especially since it looked like you guys were moving towards something of a resolution of the tension between Arwen, like Arwen and her friend fighting about it in the frame, and Arwen arguing with her friend about it, and she can come to some kind of a resolution about basically sort of the question that she can come to peace with is like, okay, well, like people want different things. Why should I try to like force this on her? Right. You know, I mean, she's made her choice about what she wants, but this could only then lead Arwen to the bigger question, really the more difficult question. Okay. But aside from our desires, right? Aside from the question of what do people want, what should we do? What's right? What is the destiny of elves? And that's a later question and a further question and a deeper question. So I kind of like saving that. That's why I like saving that for the next episode.
Okay. Do you want to have the dream itself in this episode, or do you want to have the dream afterwards? I mean, I feel like having it here and having him misinterpret it and then come to a better understanding of it later seems better, but...
Yeah, that could work. I mean, especially since if he has to have the dream also and interpret it and have... It loads a lot into episode four, especially since, you know, the right. Lenway plot is only one of a couple different plots that are happening in that episode, so it's already kind of full. He's got his hands full with Treebeard in episode four, you know?
Also, if the online etymology dictionary is to be believed, the word thrall originally comes from a Proto-Germanic word that meant runner. So working that in, not too difficult.
Well, there you are. There you are. Okay. He can have it. He can have it. But maybe he doesn't even tell anybody about it. Or I don't know. Or maybe it comes up in private. Maybe it's not a subject of public debate.
Or he could just have it and then say something during the debate to the effect of, well, you know, it's our purpose, and have the dream be about purpose and whatnot.
Right.
And right.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Shall we get into episode four so that you'll have technically left episode three?
Hey, yeah, let's do that. Because I've already done most of what I want. Oh, just a brief note. I love Muriel's family staying behind. The idea that Muriel, when she goes to Vauna, and she has her husband, but she's lost her family. So the idea of Muriel is kind of herself abandoned, and the way that that gets echoed in Feanor's abandonment, I think can resonate in lots of really cool ways. So I thought that was a brilliant touch. And I would just say also in passing, I was not a huge fan of Nerwin's kind of convoluted. First of all, who's Nerwin again?
Nerwin is she's an Avari. She's a Teleri Avari.
Right, Teleri Avari. Right. Okay, she's like the female spokesperson for the Avari that we were talking about.
Right. Yeah, yes. Right. She would have been the Arwen mentor.
The Arwen mentor figure if we had stuck with the mentor thing.
Right.
Right. Okay. All right. Got it. I thought that her kind of like her convoluted. So she's a close. She's one of Elwë's in her circle, Marie says.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Right. So it's like. So in the beginning, it should be like, you know, Elwë hanging out with Olwë and Círdan and you know, Mablung and Celeborn and Nerwin should be one of the
yes.
posse there. Though of course they don't all have to get named, obviously. Okay, all right, fine. Wasn't a huge fan of Nerwin like setting out to make one argument and talking yourself into the other side. Like, not that that's not psychologically verisimilitudinous, because it certainly is. But I mean, goodness knows I've done that myself many times on this show, live on the air many times. But I wasn't as a kind of a culmination of the episode. It seemed a little bit odd. But anyway, yeah. I just want to kind of note that in passing. But let's move on to episode four. I love Lenway and Treebeard. Like, coming back to that episode, I was like, that's just brilliant. I so love the connection of the Green Elves choice, or the soon to be Green Elves,
the proto Green
Elves, with the Ents. It's just, there's so many ways in which that is so perfect that I just can't stop loving it. Like that. Again, if we interject, the two main things that I wanted to say about this episode, we've already talked about. That is, this is where Tevildo the Torturer comes in, and so I wanted to kind of address that, and we already have. Lenway and why Lenway stays, and I wanted to come back and interject about the purpose, and we've done that. Though we didn't, what's his dream? What does he actually dream?
That's a good question.
Before the other dreams that we've depicted, that you guys have depicted in the outlines, have tended to be imagistic rather than allegorical dreams.
Yes,
they're usually not like you dream of a thing which you then symbolically interpret, right? But rather snatches of imagery, which, you know, will make sense later on. Like, I really liked, for instance, and look at me glancing ahead again because I'm pretending as if I'm covering more than we are, the dreams of Olwey and Círdan, right? Mm-hmm. The dream of the swans and the dream of Vingalot. I really liked that. Mm-hmm. So is it going to be that kind of dream? Is it going to be
I would think that kind of dream would be easier to misinterpret, but it also would be more difficult to convey a sense of purpose, is the problem.
Yeah, because and that's what I think it's, because we don't need a misinterpretation or even a public misinterpretation. He can maybe perhaps just not fully understand it. I don't even think he needs to talk about it, his dream, at the conference. I mean, in fact, maybe he shouldn't talk about it. Maybe we should show his dream and then show him looking, like, concerned, right? He's troubled at the debate. He goes with Elway, right? And follows him and sides with him, but he's troubled. And it's his dream that he's troubled because he doesn't understand his dream, right? He feels like he's being told something, but he doesn't yet get it. And it's only in episode four that he gets it. And when he gets it, he makes his choice and decides to stay. So I actually kind of think it'd be better if he doesn't talk about it. It doesn't need to be publicly misinterpreted, I think. Just not yet understood. Which could means it could be a thing that will come clear both to him and to the viewers in episode four.
Could he be cultivating a tree? Could he be dreaming about himself cultivating a tree?
Right. You got to think trees have to figure, right?
Yeah.
In this, I mean, it's got to be an Entish dream in some sense that he's having.
Yeah. And maybe have it kind of like shift into like a whole forest of trees or something like that. Like, I don't know. I'm trying to think of a way to convey purpose through that. Like, this is your purpose, to cultivate Middle Earth in a way.
Yeah. Maybe. Maybe he just has a dream of a tree talking. Like, he's just a dream of a talking tree, which he doesn't understand. You know, he's like, trees don't talk. Maybe his first impulse, and again, we don't have to, he doesn't have to say this all on screen, but maybe Lenway's own first impulse is to interpret allegorically, right?
Mm.
He has a dream of a talking tree, and he's like, what does the talking tree symbolize, right?
But that's, is the tree actually saying words? Because then what is it telling him?
I don't know.
Like, that's a problem. Like, having, I mean, you could have, and the tree doesn't look alive in any way. You just have a tree, and there's like a voice coming out of the tree, but it's muffled, and he can't understand it. He keeps asking it, "What are you saying? What are you saying?"
Right. Well, no, this is easy. the tree talks to him, and he understands it, but he doesn't remember when he wakes what it said.
Okay.
It's a dream. We can always go on the I don't remember business, right? But all he remembers, but, you know, he when he awakes, what he knows, he has this dream which affects him profoundly, and it's just...
So you're saying we don't see the dream? He's just...
We don't see the dream. Okay. It makes it easier if we don't see the dream, right?
That's true.
If he just... Because, and if all the dream is this one single, you know, it's like, I dreamed that a tree spoke to me. Mm-hmm. And he, and like, his interlocutor says, what did the tree say? And he's like, I don't remember, but it spoke. And I don't know what it means.
And there's something that I have to, that we have to do or something
right.
like
yeah,
that.
Right, yeah, exactly. But, you know, he just has the...
There's something we're supposed to do.
Yeah, yeah. He just he has the sense, like, this is really important. Like, this is a... and then when he meets Treebeard, then he understands. Like, yeah. that he can, you know... So when the, you know, they're like, oh, wait, I can teach the trees to speak.
Yes.
That's when then he connects it to, right, this is my job. This is my purpose. I've got a... I've just, you know... Yeah, yeah. I just saw a job opening posted, and I want it. good, yeah, love it. The last and most important question of episode 4, and we'll probably have to end after this, is Tom Bombadil's cameo is supposed to come in this episode, which I agree geographically it needs to. We need more details on this crucial subject. What does Tom Bombadil do? Who's going to meet him exactly?
I don't even remember
Elway?
That.
Is it in Elway's... Is Elway traveling? Does that happen? Are we yet in the point of Elway... Elway traveling? Where's the...
Well, in episode 4, yeah. There's definitely travel.
Oh yeah, well, because we actually get to Nan Elmoth in this. Right? He actually meets Million. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Right. Okay.
Do we want to have LA meeting two super powerful Maiar in the same episode?
In different forests? Yeah, probably not. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like if anybody, Finway or Inway,
it's a little bit funny having those two things happen in the same episode. You have to admit.
Yeah.
By the way, are we casting for Tom Bombadil, or did we already cast him?
I don't think there is a... I don't think he has been cast. I don't think it's even any oversight. Of the radar. Yeah.
He was in season 1. We totally need somebody to be Tom Bombadil. What an important
role that is. I don't know. I'm in scripts, not casting.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Okay, right. So,
on that one.
Right. Marie says, Olwey. It's got to be Olwey.
Okay. That makes sense.
Agreed. Now, it's a cameo, right? We don't need or want a whole scene, but what do we
Well, you could just have him like dance through singing and Olwey just watch him go by with a puzzled expression on his face. That's the easiest way to do it. But
yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And just not explain it for another 20 years.
Right, exactly. Exactly. But of course, thematically, though we wouldn't explain this or spend time in it, I mean, it works, right? I mean, the question of, like, my purpose is to remain here in this place, well, like, Tom Bombadil's all about that, right? So having him come in as Lenway is deciding to put down roots and say, this is where I belong, certainly fits thematically, even though, again, as I say, we wouldn't explain that explicitly, really. So yeah, they're gonna see him. I mean, he's gotta be like dancing along and singing, because that's what he does, right? So I mean, obviously there's really nothing else that they could catch him doing. Question: when does Tom Bombadil marry Goldberry? When do we want Tom Bombadil to meet? Since we have a Tom Bombadil, we're gonna have to have a Tom Bombadil cameo in every single season. I insist. We need to think about that. Because, of course, like, we can show the backstory of Tom Bombadil through cameos over the course of multiple seasons, mm-hmm. right?
Although, isn't it around the same time of the... Like, don't whites have to be around at that point?
Nah. The whites can come in later. Yeah.
Okay.
No, the whites come in later. But he's...
It does sound something like something primordial, like would happen before the elves arrived.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, because basically, here's my question. Because the other thing, there are a couple things that it seems to me we could see Tom doing in his cameo. And one could be sitting by the water.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as he's described in the poem, right before Goldberry grabs him and pulls him in.
Oh, that would be hilarious if that's the way he exits the scene. He gets pulled under and yes. And always just left there standing on the bank.
Right.
That would be awesome.
Always just like, huh, that was weird. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, there's just, he's just standing there in silence for like a good 30 to 45 seconds.
Yeah, it's just like,
is he,
several
is he
beats.
Coming back or what?
Right. And then they walk away. Yeah, yeah. Or I mean, we can save that. I remember we've got to play the long game with Tom Bombadil, right? We can just have him sitting by the river, and then he could get grabbed next season in his next cameo. Right? We don't have to. Though again, the juxtaposition of Tom Bombadil being grabbed by Goldberry in the same
yeah.
episode in which Melian enthralls Elway. I mean, right? There's something there. Though we could do it with Beren and Luthien again in the next like two seasons.
What you could do also is have the water be very clear and relatively shallow, so Elway looks down into the water and there's nobody there.
Right, right.
So that, like, there's no, like, oh my god, let me go help him. He can't because there's nobody
right,
there.
Right. Yeah, well, Maria's arguing that we save Goldberry, and I think she's probably right. I mean,
sad.
I want to hurry on to Goldberry, and I think we totally need to do the snatching scene. Like, Tom Bombadil has to get pulled down under the water by Goldberry at some point on screen. This must happen. But we do have a lot of time before we need. I mean, we're going to have Tom Bombadil and Goldberry happily living together in their cottage in the Old Forest in, like, what, season, you know, 20 or 15 or something like that. So we have a lot of cameos between now and then, so we probably shouldn't push it. If we saw him just kind of wandering around in his forest or, like, choosing to settle down last time, we can just have him being next to the water. So, like, that's where they see him. It's just a cameo, right? They see Tom Bombadil
okay.
next to the water, and that'll set up a future episode, a future cameo in which he gets grabbed.
Mm.
Yeah. No, you're right, Marie. We should be patient. We need to pace ourselves with Tom Bombadil.
It would have been funny.
It would be funny. And again, I'm sorely tempted by the Melian parallel. Sorely tempted. But I think it would give the wrong idea anyway about Tom Bombadil, because Tom Bombadil and Goldberry's relationship is not parallel to Melian and Thingol's, of course. So,
that's true.
So yeah, let's pace ourselves. All right. Okay. I'm gonna stop there, and that's excellent. We've covered four episodes, which is just what I planned to do. Since we're obviously going to spend three episodes going through the outlines, that puts us a third of the way through and right on schedule.
We got through. Half, slightly more than half.
No. I think we just revised history. Didn't you see how smoothly I revised history just then? You totally blew it. I was going to be like, that was the plan all along. Obviously,
no, I caught that. I was just attempting not to let you.
Well,
get
technically, yeah. We have touched on the 13th episode.
True.
So
exactly.
We've been talking about the whole season, so.
So seeing as we we reviewed at least four and a third, we're precisely a third of the way through. So, but this is really good. I hope that the other people have been really enjoying this. It's one of the things that I mean, of course, the closeness and discussing episode by episode as we go through is always great. But I dislike the fact of losing touch at the end. I'm really enjoying the opportunity to kind of do a survey and kind of rethink these things now that we're kind of seeing the big picture and holding the whole season in our minds. This seems like a very, very natural and I'm really enjoying this kind of a recap, but not just recap, sort of rediscovery and rethinking through now in the context of all the rest of it. It seems like a really necessary part of the process. So I'm sorry we didn't do this in season one, and I think this is great. So I'm very happy to carry on with this.
I do have to say that I do have a word of warning that the episode 13 session took about 6 hours or more to get it all worked out. And so if there's like, I mean, if there's more than a little change, I may have a mutiny on my hands. So
okay.
Just
all right.
Throwing that out there.
All right. We'll see. We'll see. I'm keen to talk about episode 13, so we'll see. But cool. So we'll see. We'll see where we get. So next time we'll start with episode 5. We'll do 5, 6, and 7, and we'll definitely plan. You know, so we'll shoot to go through 8 or 9. You know, mm-hmm. to end after 8 or 9 for next time, and then we'll try to do. Let's shoot for 9 so that we can have only 4 episodes for. For the last, yes. for the third session, so that we don't spill over past 3. But anyway, yeah, that'll be
including what became the 2-hour finale.
Exactly, including what became the 2-hour finale, precisely. Okay, cool, excellent, very good. So that's what we will plan for next. That'll be in 2 weeks. And so, so nominations again. Casting call, Marie. We're closing nominations on Monday of this coming week. No, next week. So a week from Monday. 10 days from today, right? Is that? No, next week. I'm sorry. Next week we're having another session because we're getting back to our original schedule. Today is the rescheduled from when I was sick. So we're meeting next week. Casting closes this Monday, 3 days from today. Okay, all right, excellent. I'm so glad that I am now clearer on this point. So we're going to meet next week. Next week we're going to talk about the next several episodes, and then this coming Monday, 3 days from now, the nominations will close for casting, and we will begin the voting and discussion and debate process on the discussion boards. Again, you guys can vote, and then we will go through that when we finish talking about the outlines and announce the official winners and cast list. Somebody should make up like a fake IMDb page for Silm Film Project. That should happen. I can't help but think. But anyway.
We are already on the TV Tropes page, just saying.
Yeah?
I cannot confirm or deny who may have had a hand in that, but it just sort of happened. Yeah. Also, I interestingly came across somebody's fanfic while I was up there. I'm not going to mention who.
Really?
Oh, but okay. somebody that we know.
Cool. All right. Excellent. So I look forward to this. So that's the path ahead. I look forward to seeing you guys next week and carrying on with the outlines. This was a lot of fun. And I will say to everyone listening, as always, thanks for listening and Godspeed.